there was a study that came out in 1992 that basically said, oh, we found that women are more upset by emotional infidelity and men are more upset by sexual infidelity. And so then we can sprinkle in some evolutionary psychology and infer that, like, oh, well, that must be because women are more upset by the idea of someone taking their provider away. Ugh. And men are more upset by someone taking their sexual object away. And everyone heard that and were like, makes sense. Love it.
Obviously.
Obviously.
If you're happy with the same old ways of dating,
if you enjoy sucking at communication,
and you have no desire to improve your romantic life, then our podcast might not be for you.
But if you want some out-of-the-box ideas to deepen your current relationships,
broaden your sexual horizons,
develop a better understanding of yourself,
or learn more about non-monogamy,
then you've come to the right place. I'm Jace.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Dedeker.
And this is the Multiamory Podcast. On this episode of the Multiamory Podcast, we're talking about the science of jealousy. Jealousy comes up in all kinds of situations and in all kinds of relationships, but in this episode, we're actually going to be looking at some research out there and kind of what's actually going on under the hood of
your emotional,
human vehicle.
Emotional car?
Yeah. Yes.
Your emotional car.
Yeah. If you had an emotional car, what would it be?
Like a DeLorean or something.
Really?
Wow.
Looks really cool,
Justify that. Breaks down
all the time.
Oh, come on. You are such a cancer.
Oh my goodness. Okay, I'm sold so quickly.
Such a cancer. Wow.
You really are a cancer.
Yeah. What would mine be? I always want to say like a Ferrari, but like that's some bullshit. So I don't know. Like a Mini Cooper or a Beetle.
Yeah, I was gonna say, okay. You definitely, okay. I could see you as a Beetle.
I mean, sure. I've had two in my life, so yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I do love that car.
What would I be? So it's
I feel like something really like hippie. Like maybe, I don't know, maybe the classiest Subaru around.
Okay, I could see a Subaru.
Okay.
I feel like I'm not quite Jeep. I'm not quite, you know, full on rugged open air Jeep, but I do feel like my emotions could be like a, I don't know, is a 4Runner a Jeep?
Toyota 4Runner.
Why do you know that?
I know quite a lot of car things. Okay. I like cars.
Because me, with my emotions, I feel it's like definitely like if there's problems, just keep on trucking and don't until the car suddenly breaks down. But yeah. It's not going to give you any kind of indication. It's real, you know, tough.
It could be like
a Grand Cherokee.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Now okay. I'm just thinking about like different metaphors
mm-hmm.
for different cars. You know, like if your emotional car is a BMW where it's like runs really great, works great, but when it breaks down, it's very expensive to fix because you need very specialized parts for it.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, or like if your emotional car is like a Honda Accord, you know, like runs great, it's really cheap to maintain, but it's also very popular to steal because, you know, the parts are so sellable.
Is that really easy for people to manipulate you emotionally?
Maybe. Because your emotions are so predictable and the parts that make them up are so widespread, people can more easily manipulate. I don't know. Jeez. I'm just trying to come up with car metaphors.
Well, please, out there, you all let us know what your emotional car is. I'm really interested in your
discussion. Yeah.
Would love to know that.
Yeah.
Anyway, to bring us back to the episode. Yeah, jealousy. It's been a minute since we've actually directly addressed a full episode about jealousy.
Yeah.
I feel personally, I mean, I don't know about what the two of you think about this, but I feel like we've avoided the specifically talking about jealousy for a while now, because for me, it's always the low-hanging fruit of anyone who identifies as non-monogamous. It's like, that's always the question. What do you do if you get jealous? Like, what if you get jealous? How do you avoid jealousy? And it's like very important questions, very important conversations to have. But I think in my personal life, I'm just like, oh, I'm sick of talking about this. And so what I tend to try to bring to the show is like, let's talk about anything but this topic specifically.
Yeah. I mean, our deconstructing jealousy episode was after we did that talk at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
It was like basically centered around what we talked about there.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, a lot of people really liked it and said that it was a great episode for them. So I guess we kind of were like, well, we're not going to do anything else about it then for a while.
We're going to quit while we're ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And like 100 episodes later, here we are again. It's pretty amazing.
I feel like part of it too might be that it's not something that comes up for us very often, going like, oh yeah, we haven't talked about that in a while, because of how often it does come up.
That's true.
In conversations, like if, you know, when
and
people
in episodes,
we talk
about it a bit.
Yeah, that's true too. But I just mean like, you know, anytime I'm interviewed by somewhere to we're writing a thing about non-monogamy and we want to learn more about it, like those are always the questions. And so I guess it's never like, man, that's something I haven't talked about in a while. Like it's always kind of there, you know?
Yeah.
So when I initially set out to research this episode, I wanted it to be about the history of jealousy, like the same way that we've examined, you know, or like read books about or seen blog posts about like the history of romantic love, for instance, or the history of the concept of soulmates. Like, I really wanted to know the history of just culturally in literature, in movies, like what is our collective cultural story around jealousy? Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to dive into that. But I ended up chasing this other rabbit of science. The rabbit of science.
What does that rabbit look like?
Science rabbit, yes. Yeah. So that's where I ended up going. I do still want to do that deep dive. And definitely if anyone has any resources out there, anything interesting they've come across specifically about that, like the history of jealousy as a concept, I would definitely love to read it. So send it my way. But we're going to talk about science, because at Multiamory, we love science.
Yeah. We do love science.
We do love science.
Yeah. So, okay. First, we're going to talk about what goes on in your body when you feel jealous. And this is something like I really remember feeling when you and I started our polyamorous journey together. And I felt like a really intense, jealous, like anger feeling like in my hands. It makes no sense at all.
Like you were going to punch something?
No, it was like a tingling sensation, like all through my fingertips too. Mm-hmm. And I used to feel like a lot of emotions in my hands. Again, no idea why. Like I could also feel like intense, like love in my hands and intense, like anger, various things. So
your emotional car is hands, actually.
There you go. Although I will say, like, that's not something that I can point to anymore. Like, I haven't recalled feeling that in quite some time. So
any kind of emotion in your hands.
Yeah, you not the same kind of thing. I'll have to think about that. But
way back
I remember
in the day, it was like jealousy lived in your hands, at least in that particular moment that you're recalling.
Correct.
Interesting. I think for me, when jealousy has struck me the most intense, it tends to be more stomach based. Like it feels like my stomach's kind of dropped out and like I definitely lose any appetite whatsoever. It's a mix between feeling like I'm really nauseated or feeling like I just have no stomach. I think that's the thing that comes to mind when I think about times that I've been really, really struck with jealousy.
Interesting. Jeez.
For me, it's in my chest. For me, it's like there's a weight, like I can't take deep enough breaths, or like there's sort of like a tightness there. And I think for me, that's also where like stress will show up for me, is kind of in my like breathing or in my chest.
Yeah,
like kind
makes
of
sense.
Like as if there's a weight there, or there's something just kind of like constricting that part of my body so it can't move as well. Yeah, so it is really interesting that, you know, we all feel it in kind of different parts of our bodies, and I'm sure other people feel it in other ways as well. And like I get the stomach thing sometimes too, like it's definitely all related, but I think kind of the main one for me is the chest. So essentially what's going on here is this is something that's known as the acute stress response, also probably better known as fight or flight. Or sometimes fight, flight, or freeze, since that is another option.
Oh, yeah.
If you've ever, you know, seen a deer in headlights, literally, that's the freeze version of the fight, flight, or freeze. So this is something that happens when we're presented with a threat, right? Like a predator or a car coming at us. Or, you know, if we're agitated or we're angry or we're scared. Right. And those feelings are very much related to jealousy, right? If you think about jealousy in terms of the fear of losing something or feeling like it's unfair that someone has something that you don't. Kind of in either case, there's elements of like being agitated or being angry or being scared or feeling threatened. And so it's bringing up kind of those same responses physically.
Yeah, and other physical symptoms, the ones that we talked about, obviously, but then in addition, things like your heart beating faster, maybe sweating, breath rate increases, you might get muscle tension, you might get sleepy in some cases, or shaky in other cases. You might have things like butterflies in your stomach or a sinking feeling in your stomach, and that can happen because blood and oxygen are being redirected. Which is really interesting. Also, the other really awful one is that sometimes, your sphincter muscles, loosen?
Yeah.
Well, so the idea is that, you know, if your body's preparing to protect you from a threat, it's redirecting all of its resources to the things that it thinks that you're going to need, like your muscles so that you can be ready to run, or increasing your the rate that you're breathing or your heartbeat so that you can pump your blood better and you can get oxygenated faster. But that means it's shutting down other parts of your body that are not
like
needed.
Like your peripheral vision,
like,
for example.
Yes, your peripheral vision, like your stomach, your digestion shuts down. One that I've read about is like the part of your brain that's responsible for converting your thoughts into speech, into words, essentially, that shuts down. And that's why a lot of people experience the sense of like not even being, that's like the scared speechless thing.
Right.
And it doesn't even have to be extreme fear, but it's the idea of like just being totally paralyzed when it comes to trying to describe what's going on or trying to put it into words.
Interesting. Wow.
And yes, part of that is the sphincter too, apparently. I think that also comes from, in a lot of animals, that when they're scared, that they'll suddenly poop or pee. And that's also kind of like getting rid of extra weight, essentially, in some species so that you can run away faster. And that still sticks around with us, too. So, you know, for some people, when they get the fight or flight response, they suddenly need to go to the bathroom.
Wow.
I think that's pretty common.
Yeah. Right.
And it's not just the physical symptoms, but of course, like in your brain as well. So like I mentioned, where, you know, that section of your brain that's responsible for converting your thoughts into words shuts down. Your mind is also going to be reverting into what I refer to as the radar system, not our radar system, but like
gotta call it something else.
The traditional, the Doppler, some kind of ultrasonic, subsonic, some kind of sonic.
Supersonic woman out of you.
Yes, a supersonic woman in your brain who's sweeping and just trying to keep track of like, what are the things that are going to hurt me? And so you're more likely, when you're in this state, your brain is going to be more likely to be thinking about all the terrible possible ways that this could go, like all of the really negative future outcomes. And it's also bringing up memories of stuff that happened in the past that resembled this situation. This is something that's referred to as state-dependent memory. So as in, when you're back in a similar emotional state, it becomes a lot easier to remember other times in the past when you were in that emotional state versus like if you're feeling great, it's a little bit harder for your brain to actually call up memories of a time that you were feeling crappy or feeling depressed or feeling jealous, for instance. And the brain does this is because, again, it's trying to protect you. It's trying to make it a problem-solving situation where it's like you go through the Rolodex of, ooh, was there something similar that happened in the past that was similar to this? Could that solution that worked then, could it possibly work now? Things like that.
Yeah. And speaking of brain functions, often it can be hard to just like snap out of the state because your frontal lobes are not engaged in this process. So we talked about this a little bit in the Wired for Love episode, which was 177. But the idea of like the primitives and the ambassadors. So the ambassadors are the things that like are able to reason with yourself and to say like, okay, wait a minute. Is this response that I'm having really, you know, justified? Is it something that I need to be doing? Do I need to be getting as angry in this moment or whatever in this moment as I am? Whereas your primitives just have that initial like automatic response. And they're the ones that are not in your frontal lobes and are, you know, making that kind of fight, flight, or freeze. That's very difficult to say.
Right?
Yes. But they're making that response as opposed to your ambassadors.
Yeah. And then kind of last thing we wanted to say about this for now, we're hopefully going to talk about this a little bit more at the end of the episode with some kind of takeaways. And that's just to to keep in mind that all of this came from a place of trying to protect you, right? Of your brain and your body, trying to protect you from real life threats, right? Like actual predators or saber-toothed tigers or other people trying to kill you or whatever it is, like an actual real like life or death kind of threat. And the problem comes about that because humans have this ability to think about things in the abstract and to, you know, actually like call up certain memories or imagine things, that this like fight or flight part of our brain doesn't always know how to tell the difference between what's a real threat and what's an imagined threat, right? This is why, say, you go and you watch like a scary movie, that you'll feel those physical symptoms of stress, right? Like maybe your palms will get sweaty, or maybe your mouth will get dry, or maybe your breathing will get shallow, or your heart will race. I know for me, like playing certain video games, I'll look at my Fitbit and I'm like, "Oh boy, that pulse is up."
Yep.
Because your body, that part of your brain that's controlling your body, doesn't know the difference between the fact that this is just sort of a mental exercise in potentially stressful situations versus actually being in those situations.
Yeah, the way that my therapist described it to me is that it's like your brain, and especially your frontal lobes, your higher brain, is like using language. Essentially, it's like texting. It's like it's trying to text your lower brain. It'd be like, hey, this is what's going on. And this person said this to me, but then this person went on this date. And then I was like, I don't know how I was feeling. And your lower brain is like, I only understand binary. Mm-hmm. Like, I only understand ones and zeros. Is it scary? Is it not? And if it's not scary, cool. And if it is scary, then I'm going to do what I do as a lower brain. That the lower brain doesn't have a sense of nuance in situations, really. Yeah. And that's why, even in situations where it's like, well, clearly my partner going on a date and me feeling threatened doesn't threaten my life, but my body's still going to react as though it does.
It is. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So that's what's happening in your body. But I really wanted to dive a little bit deeper into like, but like what's going on in the brain and like, why is this happening in the brain? And I went really far down the rabbit hole of jealousy research. And I really quickly found out there's a lot of jealousy research, but there's a lot of problems with jealousy research. Yep. And I had to spend a lot of time researching to kind of find the stuff that was actually answering the questions that I wanted. And so I'm just going to break down a couple of the recurring things that comes up in a lot of jealousy research that is maybe a little bit difficult. It was definitely difficult for me. And the first one is what's known as the JSIM or the JSIM model.
Not to be confused with JSON.
No, not JSON. The JSIM model. And I didn't know it was called this, but it's basically the hypothesis is, and this was, there was a study that came out in 1992 that basically said, oh, we found that women are more upset by emotional infidelity and men are more upset by sexual infidelity. And so then we can sprinkle in some evolutionary psychology and infer that like, oh, well, that must be because women are more upset by the idea of someone taking their provider away. Ugh. And men are more upset by someone taking their sexual object away. And everyone heard that and were like, makes sense. Love it.
Obviously.
Obviously. I first even heard that hypothesis from a friend of mine. It wasn't even in the scientific general. It's just a friend of mine being like, this is a thing, you know, this is a fact. And they're like, oh,
I learned about it in psych class in college.
Really?
Yeah. No, like that's just as if that's how it goes.
Yeah.
Well, and so the thing is, so it was, this was first published in 1992 and it has been controversial since then. I realized in researching this that in the academic and scientific communities, it wasn't like people were like, okay, great, that's a fact now. It was controversial because since 1992, there have been countless studies showing that there actually isn't much of a gender difference in the experience of jealousy.
Since 92, and yet like Dr. Drew, I swear, recently on a podcast that I listened to that had him on it, said like essentially same thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like, well, you know, but women have a harder time with emotional, you know, infidelity, right, or just they're more interested in emotions and men are more interested in
sex.
Well,
yes, it
obviously.
Just so perfectly fits into our already established cultural stories yeah. about men and women of like, yeah. oh yeah, those emotional ladies and those horn dog dudes.
Exactly.
you right. know, they're like, right. so it totally makes sense.
So why would we question
sense.
This?
Yeah. 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 And it's like, even in the academic research, even researchers are still trying to puzzle over why did this one study produce that result?
When and it, was been... it just one? It was just one and then
I'm
everybody
sure
jumped on
one.
That bandwagon?
Yeah. And then, and Tips. Why have there been so many more studies that have disproven that? And like, why did they get that result? Some people have theorized that, oh, maybe it has to do with intensity of emotion in general, that that's the difference between the genders that they surveyed. Like, I don't know.
I remember I also heard a hypothesis that it had to do with men or women being conditioned to be better at imagining certain situations.
Right, I remember that too.
So there's like lots of different explanations for it. But the point is that it's been shown to not actually be true, that that's not,
yeah,
that's not
I
necessarily
think
true.
There's been a lot of, there's been some studies that have found that no, actually both men and women are just generally more upset by emotional infidelity than sexual. And so it's actually, they're similar in that way. Other studies have shown, nah, it's just infidelity in general is upsetting to people across the board. And of course there's variations in how upset people get, but it's not really split among gender lines necessarily is
yeah.
what they found.
Yeah. And does this next quote come from the exact same study?
No. So the quote that's here comes from this book on jealousy that was published in 2010 by Dr. Christine Harris,
okay,
who is
okay.
Specifically like an emotion researcher. And she published a book specifically about jealousy and jealousy research and how evolutionary psychology theories play into that.
Yeah. And she said that ancient humans might not have been as nuclear family-esque as people often assume. I mean, which makes sense. Like, they were tribal cultures.
Right.
Way
yeah.
different than what we currently have.
Yeah.
So, should I read this?
Yeah. Go ahead right. and read the quote.
The ancestral past may have been significantly different than the one envisioned in the JSIM hypothesis. In fact, very little is known for certain regarding the socio-cultural environment in which humans evolved. One possibility is that infidelity may not have occurred at high enough rates to require the evolution of specific jealousy mechanisms. A very different hypothesis is that the ancestral past of humans may have been like many hunter-gatherer societies of the present, where sharing and cooperation are emphasized. Thus, individual males may not have been responsible for providing resources to their own offspring, since the group shared food resources. White and Mullen. 1989. Therefore, a man's inclusive fitness would not be as disastrously affected by cuckoldry as suggested in the JSIM theory.
Right. So, in other words, to kind of like cram that all down into yeah. a simple concept, is that if we're all sharing all of our food and we're all sharing in the raising of our children, both of those theories go out the window that men like had to evolve this thing to make them jealous of sexual infidelity so that they were sure they were only providing for their own children.
Yeah.
And that on the flip side of that, that women didn't have to worry, like didn't have to evolve some mechanism for being extra jealous of emotional infidelity because they were all being provided for by the entire tribe,
yeah.
not just by this one guy
yeah,
because he thought the kids were his.
I don't remember who made this observation, and I forget where I read this, but someone commented like, it's so interesting that it's like this is based on this story of like, well, you know, a woman has a baby and then she's, you know, she has to carry that baby so she can't go and get food for herself. So she's dependent on her male partner to go get her food and provide for her. But then someone commented, like, even if you believe that it's for some reason this very like dyadic,
for 9 months,
couple-y
you can't
thing.
Do anything except for sit there and carry
well,
the kid.
But even if you believe that, it's, you know, that whole problem is solved as soon as you invent the baby sling. That as soon
right.
as you're like, oh, I'm going to take a piece of fabric and strap this baby to me so that my hands are free.
Yeah.
That then it's like, okay, well, now I can provide food for myself. And then it all starts to fall apart that of this, you know, kind of painting this narrative already of even ancient human women being so 100% dependent on like a
yeah.
singular man instead
like,
of.
I don't need no man. Shit.
Well, it's not even that. Instead of just being dependent, like codependent
yeah.
on a tribe of people or multiple people around them.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So another one is that basically in the research, stuff has been shown that basically things have shown that jealousy responses can be linked to relationships lasting longer. Like, they did these studies measuring people's relative amounts of jealousy, and they found that people who were, like, more prone to experiencing jealousy were more likely to be in that same relationship after 10 years, or I forget exactly how long it was in this study.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a second.
But what the study didn't ask was, it didn't try to take any measures of whether that was a good relationship, whether those people were happy, or if being more jealous just made you more likely to hang on to and stay in an unhealthy and unhappy relationship. Mm-hmm. So that I thought was kind of interesting, and that a lot of the studies are kind of like based around this idea of trying to make the argument that jealousy is something that we've evolved, and that it's like somehow we've evolved it because we need it. Whereas there are other people saying, well, actually, maybe it's more of just kind of a side effect of other things and other ways about the ways that we work. Kind of like dreams, you know, where we don't really know what those are all about. Like, why we have those.
Like hopes and dreams. Like, why would we evolve
literally,
to have hopes? No, I know.
Literally dreams
at night. I'm riffing.
Yeah,
I'm riffing.
You're such a joker.
Such a joker.
Yeah.
I mean, you just said exactly what this quote was, so I guess you can just keep going. Yeah.
Oh, it's just, yeah, that, what was it? From 1978 to 1985.
Yeah.
So what's that? Like 7 years that people who were...
Yeah, more likely.
Yeah, we're more jealous. We're more likely to still be with that person after those 7 years.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then those who were lower on the jealousy scale were less likely to be involved with that person.
I mean, yeah, just that those two correlate. Yeah
that
but,
is fascinating. It's like
why
they,
though? And like,
well, yeah, I mean, to me, like, the only thing that potentially suggests is that someone's like, well, I need to hold on to this relationship or this person because, again, I don't want someone else to get it, which is not necessarily the case, but because they didn't ask, like, what the relationship satisfaction of those people were,
one could assess
that, yeah.
That's been the thing in a lot of this research is that there's a number of research, you know, there's a lot of research that's like, oh, like, jealousy is useful or even positive in the sense that it produces these, like, relationship preserving behaviors.
But, like, that's maybe kind of shitty, too. Well,
but then they don't also ask the follow-up question of, like, how does your partner feel about your relationship preserving behavior?
Yeah, like, what exactly does that mean? Like, what would be an example of a relationship preserving behavior?
Well, okay, well, the standard story is... like the very basic story is like, oh, you see your partner flirting with someone else, so your relationship preserving behavior is you go over and like cock block them in some way, I guess.
Like, yeah, or like, yeah,
you know,
I feel like that's on the
hit
positive
that guy or whatever.
Well, sure. I think the example Dedeker gave is the one that's given kind of in support of that, right? It's like,
yeah,
you feel this jealousy and so you're gonna do something to stop that from happening, either go and join that conversation and kind of assert your place, you know, like scare the other person off, essentially. Yeah. Which I guess, you know, scientists could view that as like, oh, that's a, you know, positive thing. It's like alerts you to keep an eye on your partner. It's very problematic.
But
on the very negative side of it is that extreme jealousy leads to things like keeping your partner isolated from their friends and from other
family
people,
and, yeah,
right? Essentially leading to abuse.
Yeah.
That, like, both of those are mechanisms that you could say do serve a purpose of preserving the length of that relationship.
Yeah.
But at what cost in either situation is very different from the other.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So you were talking about attachment theory when we were discussing this episode. And how do you think that this all, like, correlates to attachment theory? Because we've spoken about that at length. Well, I think we could do even more episodes about it. But we have talked about it in various episodes.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring it up because in another one of these papers that we read, this one was by Harris Darby, I believe. This one was kind of a... Yeah, sorry, Christine R. Harris and Ryan S. Darby. There we go. Two different last names. That they sort of did this long kind of review of all of the research that's out there about jealousy in 2010 when they wrote this, I believe. You know, kind of trying to put that together and kind of reconcile some of the different findings the different studies have found. And when it came to attachment theory, that's often brought up in relation to jealousy. And, you know, go listen to our episodes where we've talked about attachment theory for more about that. But what I thought was interesting was specifically looking at people who are securely attached. So those people tend to have a fairly good opinion of themselves and also a fairly good opinion of other people. Like, they're more likely to be trusting, less likely to constantly be worrying about the state of their relationships. And so some studies have hypothesized and then gone to show that securely attached people are less likely to feel jealousy. Mm. Like, when imagining certain situations, they'll report lower levels of imagined jealousy about that situation. But then in other studies, they had shown that securely attached people were more likely to react angrily, like to react with jealous anger.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and I guess they were trying to make the case that somehow...
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law.
See terms and conditions. 18 plus. For a long time now, we've been fans of AdamandEve.com for getting sex toys or lingerie or accessories, things like that. It's just a fantastic resource with a huge selection. And now, not only do we have a fantastic offer, but we also have a promo code that will work on AdamMale.com and EvesToys.com, which are their sites specifically for LGBTQ audiences. And our code is fantastic. It's 50% off of almost any item in the store and free discreet shipping when you use our code MULTI.
Yes, we love AdamandEve.com and have for years. They are our oldest and longest sponsor, and they just keep on giving great gifts to us and to our listeners. You can bring more pleasure and satisfaction into your bedroom by going to AdamandEve.com, AdamMale.com, or EvesToys.com and select any one item. It can be, you know, an adventurous new toy or anything you desire, something fun, something sexy, whatever sounds good.
So just enter offer code MULTI at checkout and you'll get 50% off almost any item plus free shipping. That's MULTI, MULTI at AdamandEve.com, AdamMale.com, or EvesToys.com. This is an exclusive offer that is specific to this podcast, and it's better than any offer that is currently available on their site. So again, use code MULTI to get you not just the 50% discount, but also the 100% free shipping. Code MULTI.
These securely attached people are just more likely to have like a good, strongly evolved relationship preserving mechanism or something. Like
the hypothesis is
weird and a little icky. Yeah.
Yeah. Because when I think of a securely attached person, I do not think of a jealous person.
And I don't think of an angry person either.
No, totally. Yeah. I think of someone who has like a good handle on those emotions.
Well, I think that the recurring theme here is that I feel like culturally and socially, we're always riding like this line between, do we think jealousy is a healthy thing that comes up in relationships and is an admirable thing versus do we think it's not so much of an admirable thing? And I feel like even anecdotally, just talking to people on the street, I feel like it goes both ways. Like, there are some people who are like, seriously, if my partner's jealous, like, that's a huge turnoff. Like, I'm really not into it. And then I also feel like I talk to the equal amount of people who are like, you know, if my partner doesn't act jealous, then I'd be worried.
Yeah.
You know, or kind of equating jealousy with love or attachment to a certain extent. And so I do feel like the fact that we're seeing this in the wide array of studies and surveys, I think that does reflect in the general population as well.
Yeah. Can I read these two quotes that were at the top of this,
this
thing that Harris and Darby put together?
Harris Darby.
They put these two quotes at the top, which I thought was great. One quote goes, "If you have not experienced jealousy, you have not loved." And the second one is, "Jealousy, that dragon which slays love under the pretense of keeping it alive."
Oh, it's kind of like two sides of the same coin.
Exactly, they started really this whole thing showing how, like, and these are, you know, St. Augustine and Havelock Ellis, like, both, you know, well-known philosophers or whatever you would call them. that come down on very different sides of this. So yeah, I love that they showed that like right at the start of this article.
Well, and I suppose like that, yes, usually if you are in a relationship at some point, you will feel jealous. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, mm-hmm. but it's something to at least be aware of and be aware of like how it can potentially make your relationship not good. Mm. Yeah. And to think about that.
Yeah.
Okay. So now we're going to get into what I personally think is the really interesting stuff. As I poured through all of these studies and all these different opinions and all these different like surveys and papers and journal articles, I found this one survey and, the results of which were published in 2017 in the Frontiers of Psychology journal. And the title of the article is pretty on the nose. It's The Evolutionary Psychology of Envy and Jealousy. And now, even though the phrase evolutionary psychology is in the title, the article itself is actually quite critical of evolutionary psychology itself, which I think is what got me to actually keep reading, because I've also become quite critical of evolutionary psychology in recent years.
Understandably.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that in the bonus content. But anyway, they specifically, they were trying to figure out, you know, how does our jealous and envy, like our jealousy and envy responses, like, how do they tick? How do they work? Like, what motivates them, essentially? Mm. Because, you know, the standard explanation for why this kind of nuanced emotion would have evolved is it's like, well, someone has something that you want, and so you know, you need to go and take it. It motivates you to go and take it or to get it for yourself or something like that. Like, you know, it's motivating you to preserve the relationship in some way. But the findings that they found from this survey were actually really, really fascinating.
Yeah. So one of those findings is that we tend to be more envious or jealous of someone who's similar to us, but doing a little bit better. So like, rather than someone who's doing like way, way better than us. So if we have a neighbor or a friend or someone out there who's doing, you know, slightly better than we are in their, I don't know, in their job, like they're making a little bit more money than we are, then we tend to be more jealous of them than we would be of someone like Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos. Dick. Yeah.
Right.
So our sense of envy and jealousy correlates to how relatable or attainable we feel that the other person's situation is.
Yeah. It's so interesting because if you try to make that argument of like, oh, it's just about because we want the thing someone else has, then you'd think you would be more jealous
of something like larger
of the Bill Gateses or the Oprahs of the world.
Well, maybe they're jealous of each other. Because, like, they have similar types of notoriety, I guess.
And I think it's not to say that, like, you're not at all jealous or it's impossible to be jealous of someone like Bill Gates or Oprah or whoever, but they just found that people are just much more likely to feel jealousy when it is, like, someone similar to me is making a little bit more money versus someone who's mega rich.
Yeah, I'm jealous of podcasts. People who make their entire living off of that.
Yeah, Jason and I had a conversation about that the other night when we were looking through all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. 25 million downloads. Gosh.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so what's interesting is something similar to that is like kind of being that will be more jealous of someone, say like a coworker at work who you feel like works just about as hard as you, is pretty much a peer to you, and they get a promotion. You're probably going to be much more jealous of that than someone who's just better than you, right? Maybe they work way harder than you and they get the promotion, or they're way more skilled or something. When they get that promotion, it's more likely to move into admiration.
Yeah, that's
and
really
like, wow, that person's great. They really deserved that. Maybe, I wish I was more like them, but it's not kind of that same like, what the, just life is so unfair. Like, why did they get that thing and I didn't?
Yeah.
Right? There's like a different quality to it.
Yeah.
And something that didn't get discussed in this, I just wanted to point out is I feel like this is kind of true on the other side too. If you see someone who you perceive to be doing much worse than you, that you're also less likely to be jealous of them too. Right.
Like, as in someone.
Why would you be jealous of them?
Wait, someone who's doing much worse than you getting rewarded?
Yeah, getting something good.
I see.
Right.
Oh,
like
I see.
Have a friend, like say like you date a lot, but lately you've been having some trouble finding dates, and you have a friend who like always struggles with finding dates, and they find a date, you're probably gonna be more happy for them because you kind of perceive them to struggle with this more than you.
Interesting.
And so it's like, oh, good for you. Like I'm glad you're you're coming up there. Or like with a job, you have someone you know who makes a lot less than you, and you've also been gunning for a promotion at your job, and you're frustrated you're not getting it, but then this person who makes less than you gets a promotion, you're still more likely to feel positive about like, oh, that's great. I'm glad that's working for you. I hope it will for me too.
Yeah.
As opposed to someone similar to you or just slightly above you being like, oh, why couldn't that be me?
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of interesting on both sides.
Yeah, that's
like once you move out of your immediate peer group, that's where it becomes an issue.
Right. Now I'm going to throw one more log on the fire here.
Ooh.
You and your metaphors.
This is just a little bit mind-blowing to me, and yet it makes perfect sense. So they found that we're more likely to feel envy or jealousy of someone who has what we want, regardless of whether they are happy or not.
Mm.
Now, the question they used in the survey, it's a little bit troublesome. I'll just warn you about that. But this is the question that they asked, was, let's say that I can prove reliably, either by brain scans or something, like I can prove that A, you know, the Dalai Lama is way happier on like abstract, but a very real scale. Like the Dalai Lama is for sure the happiest person on the planet.
Really? I mean, okay.
like this is a hypothetical.
Hypothetical.
Okay, Let's say I could prove that the Dalai Lama is extremely happy.
Okay.
Do you feel more jealous of him, or do you feel more jealous of someone like, say, Hugh Hefner, who has just like a ton of money, really nice house, limitless access to attractive women, but we can't tell whether he's happy or not?
Well, he's no longer with us.
Well, Emily, you got to come along with me. This is the example they used. It's called a hypothetical. Anyway, they found that people were just way more jealous of Hugh Hefner than they were of the Dalai Lama, even when there's, you know, a concrete way of proving like, yeah, this person's much happier. And I think it makes perfect sense because, you know, we look at so many people who are rich, who are attractive, who are well off, who have everything they need, but are absolutely miserable, and yet we still envy their lives anyway. You know,
yeah,
we've seen time and time and time and time again that the traditional hallmarks of success do not necessarily equal life satisfaction or contentment. I mean, look at how many celebrities and how many people who are well off who kill themselves or who struggle from depression. It's like so clear. And yet we still are more likely to feel envious of them anyway.
Yeah.
More than we would of someone who maybe is very poor or not very well off, but who was for sure happy.
Yeah.
And that's
money
really
doesn't buy happiness. Clearly.
Yes, but we don't actually believe that in our emotional car.
I know. Our emotional car doesn't believe
our
that.
Our emotional car isn't hearing it.
That's what the name of this episode should be. Yeah. The emotional car. People will be like, what?
You know, we're not, it's like there's some part of it that this is not actually pursuing happiness or peace or satisfaction. You know, that's what I think is really interesting.
Yeah. This next one, I had a little bit of a hard time wrapping my brain around, but I understand what you're saying here, Dediger, that, okay, if there were repeated examples of being jealous, not of the final level of intense pleasure or happiness, but of someone having access to and only slightly enjoying something for which you have a modest desire for and will only modestly enjoy, but you don't have access to. Does that make sense? So, yeah. So if somebody has access to something that you kind of sort of want and you don't, and they get it, and you don't even know if they really care about it or want it or not, you will still be jealous of that.
Right, that you're more likely to be jealous of those things than... It's kind of
similar to the barrier to entry. It's like if somebody out there has access to, like, yeah, a Ferrari, and I, you know, or a Tesla. I have a friend who has a Tesla 3, and I'm like, I don't know if I would actually be much happier having a Tesla 3 than my Fiat, but I want it. I definitely want it, and I am jealous of it. So even though, like, I don't know if she's happier having it either.
Right. It's kind of similar to the last one.
Yeah.
That it's really not so much about the happiness that they get from it or the happiness you would get from it.
Yeah.
But just the fact that they have a thing that you can't.
Yeah, we all want things that, like, the grass is always greener.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Another one is that we've kind of talked about this on the show in the past when we've talked about jealousy, but the researchers in this, They theorize that envy and jealousy may have evolved to motivate us to also go out and get these things that other people have done. And I suppose you could see in that way that that makes sense, that if jealousy, if like the purpose of jealousy was to help you be motivated to go get things that you didn't have, you know, to work harder for those things or to achieve them, that then it makes sense that you would feel that more strongly for things that seem more attainable, right? People who are a little more similar to you, have similar resources to you, or a little closer to you, you go, ah, I'm going to get this extra motivation to go out and get that thing. That makes sense, as opposed to someone who's just so far out of your reach that it's like, well, you know, what's the evolutionary point of being really motivated to go after this thing that seems so far off in the future?
Right. This is an interesting thing that they covered in this survey is, and okay, bear in mind, this was not a survey that was about infidelity or non-monogamy, but this question came up, and they specifically asked the men who were participating in the survey, if your female partner had sex with someone who is not you, and that person was a man, or that person was a woman, which one do you feel more jealousy about? And it was like 96% of the respondents, yes, thought that their female partner having sex with a man made them feel more jealous.
Yeah.
Which, if it doesn't sound familiar, it should, because
it's like a one penis policy?
Yeah. Well, that's usually what motivates one penis policies, I feel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. This can kind of be like an explanation for people out there who want to do one penis policies, but I don't think it's a good justification for it. But yeah, that idea, I mean, absolutely. This has happened in relationships that I've had.
Oh, wait.
Yes?
I'm so sorry to interrupt again, because there was a second part to that question that I forgot. So they did ask the one question of, like, you know, just basic man or woman, which one makes you feel more jealous?
Sure.
They also asked a question of, like, if your female partner had sex with a woman and had a really incredible, amazing, pleasurable experience versus if she had sex with a man and had like an okay experience, they still found her having sex with a man was much more jealousy producing than her having this much better sexual experience with a woman. And which, of course, we could go into a whole thing about how we feel about, you know, girls having sex with each other and whether or not female-female relationships are valid or not in society's eyes. We could go into that whole thing. But it's kind of like, outside of that, it really supports what we were saying earlier, where they find it's not about what the actual end result is. It's like, you're not jealous of her experience, of her sex being great. Like, you're jealous of like, how
the penis.
Yes.
Yeah, just this idea that, you know, another person's penis could do things that my penis can't do. And well, that, you know, it, that therefore, you know, I'll feel emasculated or whatever. I think that has come up in a lot of conversations that I've had with people mm-hmm. over the years about, you know, dating men or women, or people just being like, yeah, I'm fine with, you know, my female partner having sex with, you know, other people who identify as women, but not men. No, that I wouldn't be okay with.
Well, okay, but often it isn't even that expansive of I'm comfortable with my female partner dating other people who identify as women. Often mm-hmm. it's much more specific.
No, you're
of like,
right.
I'm only okay if this other person has a vagina. Yeah. Like, I'm not okay if this person has a penis. I don't care what their gender identity is.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
If I can kind of loop this back and relate it to the first sets of studies that we were talking about. So this one here is talking about jealousy and envy, and it's kind of asking questions, trying to tease out like what is it really about when we say we want what other people have, or we want, you know, the happiness that other people have, and kind of showing here, like them being more similar to us makes it more threatening, that their happiness really has nothing to do with it. It's just them having access to something that we don't. But if we look at the other studies about jealousy, which focus more on the type of jealousy that's like fear of losing a relationship, like we talked about what would be an example, like, you know, like with your caregiver giving attention to someone else, like that kind of jealousy, or a romantic partner being interested in someone else and showing that jealousy helped make these relationships last longer by like reacting to those threats, or like driving you to react to those threats, that I think that people would make the argument like, oh, well, that's what's happening here. It's not about whether she's having a good time with this other man or this other woman, like, or that she's having a much better time with this woman than with a man. But it really comes down to this idea that I perceive the threat of this other man as a more real threat to losing my relationship. In this case, I think it's not so much about gaining, but it's still problematic in a similar way,
yeah,
of saying, well, like, well, why is it that you are evaluating this person as like a real threat, whereas you're evaluating this woman as not a real threat?
Yeah.
And that does go back kind of in the same way to a lot of this, like, very ingrained, very unexamined sexism that we have, you know, in our society that we're taught.
Well, there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
Just all over the place.
Just all over. It's like roadkill.
Yeah.
Really. Got to dodge it with your emotional car.
Yeah.
Well, I see. We're bringing back the car metaphor. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
So with all of this, what are some takeaways? What can we like gain and put in our emotional car so that our emotional car is like the savviest, awesomest, you know, fastest?
Right. Like better shocks.
Yeah.
You know, make sure
more
we like
cylinders?
Clean out our carburetors or fuel injectors or whatever things. Change your alternators. I've had some of those go out on me.
There you go. Yeah. It's always impressive to me that like you knew how to like change your own oil.
Yeah. You know,
you changed my oil a couple times, which was hugely.
Oh my gosh.
Good God.
It's important to change the oil on your emotional car.
Yeah.
I had a friend in college who, our parents gave her a car to drive out to college. And at no point in her life had they ever taught her how to take care of a car or like the maintenance that needed to go into a car. She didn't know you had to get your oil changed because no one had taught her that.
Oh my God.
And after like a year, her car just completely locked up and was totaled because she'd never put oil in it and never gotten it changed.
No.
But like, you got
to
learn these things.
I need to get my oil changed.
Yeah, but
I'm gonna double up now.
but anyway, you know, yikes.
So it's important to understand at least a little bit about how your emotional car works so you can do some of this maintenance.
So you don't lock up and are totaled.
Right. Okay. So something that can actually be very helpful about these studies is just realizing that these things are happening inside of us and that we do have these tendencies. Like with a lot of psychological studies and things like that, people can get very discouraged by them because they'll learn about something like cognitive dissonance or about these studies about jealousy and just go, well, fuck, I'm damned to just do these terrible things and always have these assumptions.
Aww.
And right, rather than looking at this and going, okay, if I understand that these things, like that I do probably naturally have a tendency to react in these certain ways and that it's probably coming from these certain things, that actually empowers you to be able to do stuff to change that, right? Through changing your thinking or through just kind of remembering that or becoming aware of it. Yeah, like the whole knowledge is power, you know, the more you know. So I think one thing that is really helpful is to remind yourself, and I found this to be helpful for me, is to really remind yourself and check in of like, what is it that I actually want? What is it that does actually make me happy? Because maybe I'm experiencing jealousy right now over something that I don't even really want that much. And I definitely don't want it enough to put in the effort to get it like someone else has. And for me, at least, a lot of the time, just having that realization really helps take the edge off. Like, for example, if I have a partner who's going on a lot of first dates, and I could feel jealous of that, when I think about it, I'm like, you know what? I really don't want to take time for that right now. That's not really what I'm looking for right now. You know, or maybe my partner's having a lot more of a certain type of sex with other people than I'm having. And it's like, well, maybe that's actually not like a kind of sex, or I'm not really feeling like I'm lacking sex in my life, but it's like, I'm just feeling jealous because someone could get something that I don't think I can. And just having that realization is so helpful.
Yeah. I think learning about all this and reading about all this is just so fascinating. And I think the main takeaway for me and that I would want to impart to other people is that like, it's not wrong. First of all, it's not wrong to feel jealousy. Like it's not wrong to feel these things. It's it's a thing, you know, like it's there for a reason. It's part of our nervous system. Again, it's part of this whole complicated system that is protecting us. And it's okay that you feel something, and your feelings are not necessarily facts. It's, you know, like just because you feel this way, it doesn't, you know, you feel, you know, like in Jace's situation where it's like, maybe you feel jealous that your partner's going on a bunch of first dates with a bunch of different people, that you don't have to jump straight to, oh, that must mean that's what I want, so I have to pursue that too. You know, maybe after you examine it, you do realize, hey, actually it would be kind of fun to go on a first date. So maybe I do feel motivated to put in the effort for that. But maybe upon examination, you realize, actually, no, actually, I'm kind of glad.
I don't want that at all.
Yeah. Being able to have my time. And so it's okay. Just put a critical eye on your own feelings and on your own thoughts, and that'll serve you.
Yeah. And when you're going through these emotions, understand that they're, you know, biological responses to a degree. So you can thank your brain and your body and your nervous system for doing things that they were meant to do. Because again, your body is just trying to make sure that you're safe. And even if it's not like putting a lot of thought into why, or if that's, you know, a valid concern at that present moment, it still is doing the thing that it's meant to do. And so, you know, it's okay from time to time, instead of getting angry at yourself, like, oh, why am I so pissed off right now? Or, oh, why am I so sad right now? Or why do I feel jealousy, or whatever it is, to be like, hey, like, I'm having a biological response. It's going to be okay. Thank you, body, for doing that. Mm-hmm. I'm good, really. But yeah, you can calm down. But thank you for taking the time to do what it's meant to do.
Yeah, I love that. Like, just that, like, it's not because you're broken.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like
something
this
to learn over the years, for sure. Yeah, I think, like, from all of us,
your mm-hmm. body's just trying to take care of you. It's just doing its best. You know, your brain is trying to take care of you, and it doesn't always do the best job of it, but it's trying real hard. And just, I think, just accepting that can be so good. And then another one that this came up in one of the other studies here is that there have been studies showing that our perceptions and our reactions to jealousy situations does really change depending on kind of the status and the relationships between all the people involved. And so in these studies, they've shown that, you know, children as young as like 6 months old will express jealousy, essentially, of their caregiver giving attention to someone else over them. And so that's part of that argument of like, well, jealousy is this, you know, it's this evolved thing that helps us to get the care and the connections that we need. But what's interesting about it is they found that as early as 4 years old, we start changing our understanding of these threats. And so in the example here, which is from a 93 study by, oh boy, Manskuch and Keenapple.
Like pineapple.
I just took a stab at those two there. That in this study, they found that as early as 4 years old, that children will be less jealous of their caregiver giving attention to an infant than they are to someone else who's more of a peer. The idea being that by 4 years old, they have enough understanding to see that infants need more care than toddlers do. Like they are, right? They understand they need that. And so attention being given to them isn't going to be perceived with the same level of threat. And I think that if we take this knowledge to just go like, look, see, jealousy isn't something that's just fixed forever. But as we learn more about other people in the world and other people in that situation, and we kind of broaden our understanding like that infant has by the time they're 4 years old, and then continuing on as they get older, that can actually change our experience of, like, actually change our experience of that jealousy. And I know that I can say for personal experience, that has been the case for me in my relationships with my partner's other partners. Or them going on dates or having sex with people, that at first those things, you know, even if I was intellectually okay with them, evoked a little bit more of like an emotional, physical jealousy response or a fear response or like a competitive response, something like that. But as I've gotten to know sort of non-monogamy better, and I've gotten to know, you know, some of my partners better, and also just kind of had more experience and kind of learned through experience and seeing
yourself
like
better.
knowing myself better and kind of seeing what things aren't actually the threats that I may have thought they were, that has changed how I actually feel about that jealousy. It doesn't mean I never feel it, but it's like the volume on that in certain situations is turned way down. Because I have this different perspective.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, reading this thing about the 4-year-olds, I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, we're all like those 4-year-olds who are just having to learn like what things aren't threats. Like, it's not about learning what things are threats, but like learning what things aren't threats. I think that's a very powerful thing that we can take with us into our lives.
The 4-year-old can do it. We can all do it.
Yeah, come on, everyone.
Yeah. So we would love to hear from all of you what your experience has been with this. Do you have things in your life that you were jealous of that you're not now? What do you feel like changed for you about that? Or what kind of car is your jealousy? We would love to hear either one of those. And the best place to do that, the best place to share your thoughts with other listeners and with us, is in this episode's discussion thread in our private Facebook group or in our Discord chat. You can get access to these groups and join our exclusive community by going to patreon.com/multiamory. In addition, you can share publicly on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can email us at info@multiamory.com. Leave us a voicemail at 678-MULTI-05, or you can leave us a voice message on Facebook. Multiamory is created and produced by Dedeker Winston, Emily Matlack, and me, Jace Lindgren. Our episodes are edited by Mauricio Balvanera. Our social media wizard is Will McMillan. Our production assistant is Nicole Samra. Our theme song is Forms I Know I Did by Josh Anonin from the Fractal Cave EP. The full transcript is available on this episode's page on multiamory.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.